Good morning once again. Welcome to Graham. It is my privilege to be able to speak with you, to you this morning from the book of Proverbs. Mike is on a bit of an extended vacation for the summer. Give him a little bit of time off and time away. So I get the opportunity and the privilege to be able to share with you this morning. As the youth pastor, I get lots of different opportunities. A month ago, like I said, we were in Chicago, and it was a great week with 10 students and enjoying and appreciating that opportunity to be there and investing in them and even growing myself. And beyond that, also yesterday I had the opportunity, being a youth pastor, to put on a giant inflatable bubble and plow them over. So that was also thoroughly enjoyable. And I think I came home after that, and I told my wife, I am getting way too old for this. These guys complain about their sore. You don't even, come on now, seriously. But also, I am grateful for the opportunity to be able to speak with you this morning and tell you some truth that not is my truth, but is God's truth from His Word to be able to share with you this morning. Last week, John Murphy began this journey through the book of Proverbs, and he explained to us and exposed to us what Proverbs are and what they are for and how they apply to our lives. And as just a really quick reminder, you heard that Proverbs fill in the kind of little daily stuff of life, because we have the Bible, and even if we think about the Old Testament, the people who have originally received and heard the Proverbs would have only had the law. But there's so much space in between that obedience that they needed to fill it in, and wisdom fills in that space that each and every single one of us have between our specific obedience. And then he also mentioned something that was perhaps a little bit insulting, and he told us that really we are simple and naive people. I'm like, thanks, John. Looking forward to you speaking next week. Please come next week. I didn't mean to tell you that. But really, that's the goal of Proverbs, the entire book, is that we are simple and we are naive, and that's almost gracious because it gives us room to grow. It gives us room to pursue wisdom. It gives us an opportunity to say, I'm not there yet, but God desires for me to be, and I will follow that path of wisdom as well. So if you were here last week, maybe you walked away and you were really motivated, you were really inspired, you were really challenged. I was even talking to some teens afterwards, I'm like, man, I need to read through the book of Proverbs. If that's you, please do that as well. If you don't have a Bible, you can go ahead and download an app. Usually they're free on your phone or your device. Or if you don't prefer one of those, then you can just take a Bible right out of the seats in front of you this morning. We would love to have that be our gift to you to pursue wisdom. But you walked away last week and you were inspired and you were motivated and you're challenged. You get in your car, you ride home and you're sitting there with your family and you're eating dinner together and you're like, man, wisdom is so good and wisdom is so great. And you're like, yeah, I just love wisdom. I can't wait for wisdom. Me too, says your daughter. That's so awesome. Let's just do wisdom all the time. And it's like, yeah, wisdom, cool wisdom, great wisdom. So now what? Because you have this desire for wisdom, but the question that we are going to ask ourselves today is, where do I get it? Where is this wisdom? Where does it come from? And if that's not the question that you're already asking after John Murphy was done last week, then you don't really have a choice, because that's the question that we're going to be asking this morning as well in Proverbs chapter 3. Here's where I'm going to start today, though. Sometimes the person on stage says, I'm a really good communicator, or they like to like kind of play tricks a little bit, and they say, I have this really big idea, and I have this really big thought that I'm just going to kind of dangle out there the whole time, and it's just going to be out of your reach, and then at some point, I'm just going to drop it on you, and you'll be like, wow, that is the greatest truth that I've ever heard in my entire life, and now everything's just coming together in my mind, and it all makes sense, and that was the best sermon ever. As much as I'd love for you to go home saying those words this morning, that's not what I'm going to be doing this morning. Because this question, where is wisdom, is kind of an obvious question. It's painfully obvious, and there's really no need for us to avoid it. And it's the answer that you would probably look for at church. For example, little Timmy is hanging out in Sunday school class one morning. And the Sunday school teacher says, what lives in a pond, has feathers, and goes quack, quack? And she says, Timmy, do you know the answer to this question? And Timmy is perplexed, and he says, it sure sounds like a duck, but since I'm in church, I know that the answer just has to be Jesus. This morning, you're going to have both answers. we are allowed to have both the duck and Jesus this morning. Sitting in your seat, yes, the answer is Jesus. But you're going to say, but that sounds a whole lot like wisdom. Sounds a whole lot like something I can do tomorrow at work or this afternoon with my family or with my friends or with my neighbors. So you will have a little bit of both. Yes, there is Jesus, but there's some very common, very normal, very everyday circumstances that we are going to be finding this morning in Proverbs chapter 3. If you're not there already, we're going to be on page 528 if you're going to be using a seat Bible that we have available for you this morning. And before we get into that, Proverbs chapter 1 and chapter 2, they're the introduction to wisdom. Perhaps we could consider it Solomon selling his book. It's kind of the inside flap of the book of this is what wisdom is. And the reader is left, maybe as you were last week, having an appetite for more, desiring more, looking for more, wanting more. And they come to the end of chapter 2 and they're like, where do I go from here? Where do I go for wisdom? And then they fall right into the following verse of Proverbs chapter 3. Proverbs chapter 3, if you're looking at it on your device or also in your Bible, it's set up as poetry. You're going to notice that there's some interesting spacing between each of these paragraphs, and the lines are abbreviated or lengthened depending on where they're at within the chapter. And what it's showing us is this pattern is saying this is our form of Hebrew poetry. And we're going to read it this morning in four different chunks. And each of these chunks is a part of that poem. And each of these chunks is going to take its own form, its own theme, its own character throughout each of these phrases of the poem. And they're going to teach us practically. And we're going to hear some things that we can take with us as we go home. But more importantly, this chapter is going to tell us about Jesus. This chapter is going to show us who he is. And that's our goal that we're going to be doing here this morning. And the first portion, the first part of this poem this morning is going to direct us to find wisdom in our character. Wisdom in our character. Follow along as I read verses 1 through 12. Solomon writes, "My son, do not forget my teaching, but let your heart keep my commandments. For length of days and years of life and peace they will add to you. Let not steadfast love and faithfulness forsake you. Bind them around your neck. Write them on the tablet of your heart, so you will find favor and good success in the sight of God and man. Trust in the Lord with all your heart, and do not lean on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him, and he will make your paths straight. Be not wise in your own eyes. Fear the Lord and turn away from evil. It will be healing to your flesh and refreshment to your bones. Honor the Lord with your wealth and with the first fruits of your produce. Then your barns will be filled with plenty and your vats will be bursting with wine. My son, do not despise the Lord's discipline or be weary of his reproof. For the Lord reproves him who he loves as a father the son in whom he delights." Sitting in church here this morning, this first point may push you back a little bit. Because you're sitting in your seat and you're attentive and you have your Bible open in your lap or on your app and you're certainly not surfing social media at all. And your notes are all lined up and your pen is clicked and it's ready to go, waiting for the next line to show up on the PowerPoint. And you're just ready to go to learn and to grow. And all of these signs point to a thought that you're saying, tell me what I need to know. Tell me what I need to know. Here's the important truth of wisdom. It can be taught. But perhaps wisdom may not be learned. It can be taught. But instead, maybe we should see it as needing to be nurtured. Because God in these verses keeps pushing us back from our natural tendencies. Our natural tendency says it's my knowledge, it's my intellect, it's my education, it's my attendance, it's my vocabulary, it's my mind. And it's not about tell me what I need to know. It's tell me what my heart needs. The word heart comes up three times early in these verses of the chapter. In the first verse, what fails though? What fails is the mind, because it forgets. But what overcomes the mind? The heart keeps the commandment while the mind forgets it. Verse 3, the memory isn't made in our mind. The memory is written on our heart. Verse 5, we don't assent or trust God by just acknowledging him. We trust in our heart, which is the opposition to understanding of our mind. The mind gets all the celebration. It really does. We have vocabulary. We have game shows. We have trivia. We have degrees that we give to people because their minds are good enough and strong enough and able enough. We hand out GPAs and scholarships to the people whose minds are ready and willing and able. But we can invest in our minds and come up very poor in wisdom. Because investment in wisdom is found in the rich soil of our hearts. And if we're going to return to Christ, if we're going to follow Christ in wisdom, is it not Christ who's after our hearts and after our lives, not just our assent and not just our knowledge? Wisdom is your character, not just your mind, but also your heart. This character shows in verse 3 with love and faithfulness, because love and faithfulness is not something that we learn or we acquire or we're tested upon. Love is not bound by an intelligence, because if it is, my 2-year-old tells me, "I love you," and I could point to him and say, "Liar," because of his intelligence. Or perhaps my uncle has Down syndrome and he's had it his entire life, and of course that compromises his intelligence and his capacities, but does that mean that he's not able to actually have a relationship with another human being? Because his intelligence isn't there? Or faithfulness. Faithfulness is less like a classroom and perhaps more like a garden. It's not that you teach faithfulness to grow, and neither would you take a book or an encyclopedia or show a YouTube video to a tomato plant sitting out in your garden. Watch this. This is how it's done. Ta-da. But instead, faithfulness is nourished. It's nurtured. It's fertilized into the very soil of the heart. And faithfulness isn't defined in the mind. It instead is grown in the heart. Again, character is what sustains wisdom by love and faithfulness. And now we add trust and humility. There are two more character forms that come in verses 5 and 6. And we find perhaps in verses 5 and 6, and John Murphy is going to revisit these verses again next week, but just real quickly to touch on them. We find perhaps the greatest intersection between the argument for your heart and character and also your mind and knowledge. In the midst of some of the most popular verses in the entire book of Proverbs, if not the Old Testament, we see that trust comes from the heart. And it's in contrast to the knowledge of the mind. Instead of following our own ways, our own perspective, we say, "No, my heart will lead, my heart will take me," when it's based on the Lord. And it's perhaps the starkest contrast that we find the greatest beauty. The jeweler sets his gems against the black velvet background and sets the brightest lights upon them so that that contrast, that stark difference, can shine every facet through. The photographer looks for the greatest contrast so that the subject can get the most attention, the most beauty, and the greatest effects that it can have. And here the beauty of wisdom is set when the heart is set brilliantly against the mind. Yes, there is knowledge. Yes, there is some degree of intelligence that comes into it, but let that be the background instead of the foreground. Let God shine upon your heart before he shines upon your mind. The mind and knowledge play the background and they play the accent, so we should be careful not to allow it to become the foreground or allow it to become the focus. Then honor comes to play in a very practical way of finances, is how Solomon shows that honor can be done in many different ways, in many different forms, in many different opportunities in life. But Solomon decides that he's going to just illustrate it with finances. And the example of the heart is perhaps in these verses, the opposite of what the logic of mind says. Because if we did what the verse says, if we wanted to pursue what the verse has to offer, barns of plenty and copious amounts of wine, or maybe in modern day interpretation, plentiful provisions and an excess of luxuries and comforts. If we want those things, if we want our provisions, we work harder. If we want luxuries, we find some overtime. We get a better degree. We take a little bit more training. We pursue something that perhaps we couldn't have done before. We push harder to find that better income, to learn more, to grow more. But honor in the heart is once again in contrast of the logic of mind. I don't think that this is a promise passage. I think it's an emphasis passage. Because the emphasis is that honoring God isn't always logical. Honoring God doesn't always make sense. Honoring God may look the opposite of what the world says you're supposed to do to honor Him. For finances, in this case, God is better. For relationships, pursue God's will above what the world says. For education, perhaps education is oversold and God is undersold. For status, maybe you say, I'd rather my status be found in the Lord than my status being found in myself. In our efforts, in our knowledge, in our logic, they're all going to fall short of the value that God places upon His character in our hearts and in our lives. And God's willing to reinforce that with these last verses of loving discipline. Because let's be honest, we don't always get it. We don't always buy it. And we sit here thinking, what on earth did I do to deserve this? Where is this coming from? And there are certainly many answers to that question. But one we need to consider is that perhaps God is trying to get our attention. Perhaps God is trying to refocus us away from our mind and away from our knowledge and away efforts and instead toward a heart of character that follows after Him. To say it's not about knowledge, it's not about earning, it's not about pushing, it's not about pursuing, it's not about human knowledge, it's about your heart, and I'm going to push you back to love and faithfulness, and maybe that's going to hurt and strain a few relationships. I'm going to push you back to trust and humility, and maybe that means it'll cost you a job or some failure at some point along the way. I'm going to teach you honor, even if that means you're going to have to do something that will cost you some status and will cost you something that before gave you some honor. Because God says, I love you. Your character is way too important to me to not discipline you, to not push you. I want you to be my child, a child after my heart. And that's what wisdom is about. It's a heart, not the mind. It's about character, not knowledge. And wisdom of God is the path of teaching our hearts beyond educating our minds. Wisdom desires our heart over our mind. It sounds a whole lot like wisdom. But we know that the answer is Jesus. And here's how we find our wisdom in Jesus' character. Jesus represents the character of God. Jesus represents the heart of God. And Jesus is the one who did keep God's commandments in His heart, when also in His mind, and also in His action, in a way that none of us would possibly be able to even understand or do or perform on our own. And He is the one who trusted the Lord with His whole heart, trusted even to the point of death upon a cross. And then we have this discipline part, and that makes so much sense with God, because He didn't despise the Lord's discipline, He embraced the Lord's discipline. Knowing that the Lord reproves him who he loves as a father would the son in whom he delights. We can certainly find opportunity for wisdom in our character, but Christ shows us what that wisdom is in perfection in a relationship with God. Because Jesus' character led to discipline and also to our opportunity for salvation. And there's much work, and that's a difficult start. It's toil, it's instruction, it's hard. There's almost this sense of resistance to all of this thought of being reformed in our character. And God and Solomon and all of his wisdom, they understand that weight, and the tone changes from discipline to reward for the following verses. And we find wisdom in a very different way because now we're motivated toward it. He understands that, wow, this has been heavy. Tone change. Starting in verse 13, reading through verse 18. Blessed is the one who finds wisdom and the one who gets understanding. For the gain from her is better than gain from silver, and her profit better than gold. She is much more precious than jewels, and nothing you desire can compare to her. Long life is in her right hand, and her left hand are riches and honor. Her ways are ways of pleasantness, and her paths are peace. She is a tree of life to those who lay hold of her. Those who hold fast to her are called blessed. And the verses now have this positive, uplifting, bright tone, inspiring feel. And we start these verses with a scent of blessing in the air. Blessing is the bookend of this portion of the book. And the beginning, the first word is blessing. The final word, final phrase also includes blessing. The blessing, the happiness, the good fortune. When we find it at the beginning, at the front end, when we find wisdom, we find blessing. Quick application there. If you're thinking it's too late for you to find wisdom, man, I've been to church for so long, man, I've been around. You don't even know how old I am, Bob, you know. It's been so long since I've even found any wisdom. The first time you find wisdom, the blessing is still there. And at the end of the verses, blessing is the continuation of holding on to wisdom over and over and over again, and we are still blessed. The application here is don't give up on wisdom. The blessing will continue. The blessing will come. The blessing will follow, whether you're at the beginning or the end. And the beauty of this is that wisdom is not discerning. There is no pay scale. There is no tenure. There is no seniority. There is nobody who deserves the blessing of wisdom more than anybody else does. It's an equal opportunity for every single person who chooses to pursue at any time, at any place, at any opportunity. The blessing works out in gain. And in our minds, we think, yes, this is it. This is totally what I've been looking forward to. This is the opportunity, almost as though we could trade in our wisdom points for something. Or, I've been so faithful and I've been here for so long, let me appraise my investments into wisdom, because wisdom does have gain. But the gain can't be quantified. The gain can't be compared. And the wise author, remember who wrote this, is Solomon, who we say is generally the richest man in all the earth. The richest man in all the earth is the wise author who attempts to make rich comparisons. But he fails at every attempt. Oh, wisdom, it's a whole lot like, it's like silver. Yeah, silver, no. He didn't have an eraser, apparently, so he couldn't just, like, strike that out. No, but it's more like gold. It's definitely gold, because gold's really rich and doesn't cut it either. Jewels, because Solomon had all these things available to him. Jewels, I really like my jewels, and jewels are really good. So it's a whole lot like jewels, because they're so precious and they're so hard to find. So it's got to be a whole lot like, you can, like, hear him throw in the towel and be done at the end of the day, because he says, I give up, because there's nothing that can possibly compare to wisdom. And understand that Solomon makes these comparisons with every opportunity that he could cash it in. He knows what silver is worth. And he can say, here's some silver. If I had silver to offer you, I'd give it to you. But no, I'd rather give you wisdom. Oh, if I could give you something rich, I could give you gold. No, actually, wisdom is better. If I could give you jewels, no, I can't even give you jewels that are worth as much as wisdom. And he would know the value of each of these things. Because God and the world and Solomon cannot offer us anything of greater value, of greater gain than wisdom itself. Then there's a really short but significant verse that's showing us a visual that you can't go wrong with wisdom. It's the man who hands out the candy to kids at church. And I think that ever since the first church in Acts, this has been like a secret position that's always been at church. Like, right there, it's like, pastor, elder, deacon, candy man, all right in the same spot. And he kind of unwillingly or unknowingly took a trick from wisdom, because he stands holding out two hands. And he knows in his mind, in both of my hands, I got something sweet for you. In both of my hands, I got a treat for you. In both of my hands, I am going to give something that the sugar-motivated buzz child needs. But he understands the kid maybe is saying there's a sense of risk. What if I pick the wrong hand? I'm going to go home without candy. That's when the candy man gets fired. So far, so good. And wisdom stands in front of us with so many opportunities, holding out two hands. And in wisdom's mind, both hands are ready to go. Both hands are ready to give riches. Both hands are ready to give honor. Both hands are ready to give long life. A little quick time out, we'll come back to this. Who wants long life? I mean, I don't really know if that's worth it. Well, if you live wisely, you will. We'll revisit that in just a second. But the skeptical, logic-seeking recipient looks at wisdom and they're saying, what's the trick? What hand am I supposed to choose? What if I choose the wrong hand? Wisdom's going to let me down and wisdom's going to disappoint me. But as delighted as the child is when he says, I'm going to pick the right hand, he's equally as happy as if he would have picked the left. So delighted is the person who seeks wisdom and they pick a hand knowing that they will have a full reward no matter what their choice is, as long as it's a choice that's made within wisdom. Back to that thought of life. Who wants that? Who wants that life? What if a life lived wisely is a life that's defined by pleasantness and peace? Would you not desire that life? Would you not pursue that life? Would that not be the offer of the life that you're saying, yes, I would love a long life. I would love for that to continue on. Because at this point, wisdom's not holding out her hands. Now she's giving you directions. And they say that the way, the directions that wisdom give is toward pleasantness and is toward peace. If you take one way or the other way, you're going to find pleasantness. If you take the other way, you're going to find peace. And they're not mutually exclusive. Perhaps they're two lanes in the same road. Pleasantness on the left, peace on the right. Which brings us to the biggest motivation. If only wisdom could reform my life. If only wisdom could give me something that does not fulfill me currently, because there's been a change I've been craving. And what is that? It's considered a tree of life. It's not talking about health or vitality or success or riches. Instead, it's talking about quality or character of life. Because why would that not be a motivation toward blessing? Why would that not be considered a gain? Why would that not be something that would be pleasant or peaceful? Because here at church, we need to understand really what offer wisdom gives us. Here at church, we are given an opportunity to actually pursue a life that is worth living. And we have access to that. We have access to a life that is worthwhile, that wisdom has to offer. But do we take him up on that? Or even more so, maybe it's not just a selfish, I want wisdom, I want that life. How many of our friends and how many of our neighbors and how many of our family members and how many of our coworkers and how many people are we aware of in this world that say, man, maybe the words from their lips, I just wish I had a better life. I just wish I could get out of this situation. I just wish I could find some hope. I just wish I could find some peace. I just wish I could find something pleasant. I just want some of this gain and this. I just wish I could have a blessing. There's opportunity for a world that craves what wisdom is extending, and that we may be able to extend to them as well. May we be motivated by wisdom, and may others see the motivation and be drawn to it, that we may offer that to them as well. So where is Jesus? Where is Jesus in this motivation? Jesus understands the motivation far better than you and I could ever comprehend. Jesus saw the blessing that was ahead of him, and he knew that it couldn't be measured in any physical riches. He agreed with Solomon. But he knew it could only be measured by spiritual riches. He knew that wisdom is a tree of life to those who lay hold of her. But if you'd allow me to play with these words a little bit, he lay hold instead of the tree of life. He laid hold to the tree of death for himself, that it may become the tree of life to us. That we may be able to hold fast to it, and that we may be able to be called blessed. I hope and I pray that you are motivated to find wisdom in simple areas and ways of your life. Take advantage of it. Cash that in. Find that value. Show it to others. But even more so, knowing that Jesus pursued that blessing, that we may find a great blessing and salvation above and beyond any other. We find an address that Solomon writes. He's saying this to somebody in particular in a verse that we're about to read to show that wisdom is also from experience. Wisdom is from experience. Verse 21 through 27, the first two words is the address. My son. And he continues on. Do not lose sight of these. Keep sound wisdom and discretion, and they will be life for your soul and adornment for your neck. Then you will walk in your way securely, and your foot will not stumble. If you lie down, you will not be afraid. When you lie down, your sleep will be sweet. Do not be afraid of sudden terror or the ruin of the wicked when it does come. For the Lord will be your confidence and will keep your foot from being caught. Do not withhold good from those to whom it is due when it is in your power to do it. Because this idea of experience starts with that address, and the address is to a son. And again, here there's a change in tone where we began with an instructor and then we moved to a motivator. Now we find a somber father whose eyes perhaps are focusing not on the son who's sitting in front of him, but instead are focusing upon his past. And maybe in his past he finds victories of the days that he brought wisdom along with him and he was successful and he found those motivations that we just read about. Or maybe he thinks about the days of defeat when he wishes he would have taken advantage of what wisdom was and what it had to offer. And he tells this portion as a narrative, illustrating it as a journey, as a time spent traveling. And on this path, he's going to find just this path and also a need for rest and even others along the way. And the father thinks of how he's learned that wisdom creates security. But what creates security is his experience. For example, very early on Thursday morning, there was a pretty significant thunderstorm that came through our area. My wife, Carissa, and I jumped into action. She headed downstairs to mop up the fact that we left our windows open because all week long, 4 inches of rain. Pfft, yeah, right, that didn't happen until 3 a.m. on Thursday. That's okay. She heads downstairs to take care of that, and I make my way into my 2-year-old son's bedroom, who's already borderline hysterical because of the couple loud claps of thunder at that moment. But what I have that he doesn't is experience. I cuddle up next to him in the generous 4 inches of bed that he decides that he's going to give me. And we lay there together, and I tell him, "You're safe. It's not rocket science, but you're safe because you're in my house. You're safe because Dad's here with you. You're safe because it's going to be over soon." It's not like what I had to say was anything significant or scientific or even tangible. But it was significant because it came from an experience from a trusted source. As a father, being trusted source of security, my boy found safety by my very simple experience. And the verses talk about two levels of security that wisdom provides and experience. The first level of security is a very common level, just opportunity throughout the journey that you'll find security on. The Bible often considers daily living as walking a path. Even today, we consider life a journey, and it's a timeless illustration that is across time as well as across cultures, that everybody understands this journey, this path. And with any path and with any journey, there are going to be insecurities and unknowns and doubts and worries and concerns and fears, because we're all going to encounter them. But what is helpful is someone who has walked the path before, one who knows what lies ahead, one who knows, hey, watch out for that turn, it's going to come on you pretty quick. Hey, watch the path, it kind of falls off there. There's that loose spot, there's that rock, there's that root. You need to make sure you're watching out for that portion. And it makes sense, and then we bring it into our real life. A recent grad in transition is on a brand new path that they've never been on before. A man switching jobs has found a new turn that he didn't even anticipate coming along the way. A new mom finds herself in a jungle that she didn't even know was worth exploring or was even in existence before. And someone, however, has walked before them. Really quick application. You are likely a source of wisdom. You are likely a source of wisdom for somebody who's worn out, who's tired, who's tripped and who's fallen, and who needs help getting back up. Because your old and tired and worn path is someone else's new, unknown, uncharted territory. And the journey isn't just what's known, though. It's also what's unknown. And there are paths that people before you have journeyed and can guide, but greater perhaps is the part that nobody can help. Because now the person on their journey needs to take a break. They need to take a nap and they take a rest, so they lay down and they're asleep. But as you're asleep, you now find that you're completely in the most unknown, most vulnerable, most unaware portion that you could possibly be on your journey. When enemies can attack, when storms may roll in, and when terrors are going to arise. And you're defenseless. And you're helpless. And you're probably afraid. It's not just my little boy. It's every single one of us. What do we do when we're on our journey and we're helpless and we're defenseless and we're afraid? In situations that are beyond our control, even beyond our awareness, we trust in the security and the experience of others who have been there. And when they look back, they're going to say, I don't know what I did there, but I do know what God did in me there. And at those times, the Father reflects and He only sees not His knowledge or not His wisdom. He only reflects and He says, I only see God there. Now the Father reconnects His story from not just the traveler, but now to the path that they're traveled on, because we can be confident in the one who makes the way, the one who makes the road, the one who directs that path. It's about the God who's established it. Yes, it's lined by people who have walked it before. Yes, there are people who have been down that road before. But it's guided and guarded by the God who establishes you and with the confidence of the people surrounding you. And they will say, it is God who guides you. It is God who guards you. And we find that we're not on a journey of exploration any longer. We're on a well-defined path. We're on a well-guarded path. We're on a well-guided path. And our personal adventures, they're going to change from one person to the next when we understand that the entire trip, however, has been planned by God, has been secured by God, and other people have gone along the way and they say, yes, I do remember going down that path. Yes, I do remember that difficult time. Yes, I do remember that hard trial. But yes, I do remember trusting God through it all and continuing on as I followed after Him. Because I found God protecting me, and I found God guiding me above all else. And here's this last part. You never journey alone. You never journey alone. I love the parental tone that is in this truth. Have a good journey. Stay strong on your trip. Don't be scared. And the kid starts walking away. And maybe it's just kind of just getting a little bit out of sight. And then mom, I think this is the only mom written portion of Proverbs, mom speaks up and says, and be nice. That's a simple but important reminder for our experiences. We never experience alone, and we're never journeying completely on our own. We will encounter other people. And when and if and how we do, what do? We look for goodness. We look for goodness in them. We look for opportunities to demonstrate goodness to them. And another interesting insight here is that experience rarely tells you to be mean to other people. Wisdom says, experience says you should be kind to other people. Make sure that we take the opportunity to be kind. So let's look to Jesus and His experience, because Jesus gives us an understanding and a new perspective on experience, because He understood the path that He walked toward death. Understanding that He proceeded in confidence that only the Lord can provide. And He had plenty of terrors and traps and difficulties that lie ahead. And He withheld nothing that was good, even from those who didn't even deserve what was good. That was entirely within His power to do good. And it is that power that is the power of salvation that allows us to walk our path of salvation here today. Because Jesus understood His path. It wasn't a good path. But He said, it is a good path. And I will walk it for the good of others that will walk with me as well. And we gain this understanding of Solomon and understand this experience to his son, and we understand and value us finding wisdom and experience, but we pray that we also find wisdom in who Christ is and what He's done. Last point. Wisdom says, speaking of relationships, let's talk about that a little bit. And that's another place that we're going to find some wisdom. And He encounters three different types of relationships, three people that we'll encounter along our journey in verses 28 through 35. Verse 28 says, do not say to your neighbor, come and go and come again. Tomorrow I will give it when you have it, when you have it with you. Do not plan evil against your neighbor who dwells trustingly beside you. Do not contend with a man for no reason when he has done you no harm. Do not envy a man of violence and do not choose any of his ways, for the devious person is an abomination to the Lord, but the upright are in his confidence. The Lord's curse is on the house of the wicked, but he blesses the dwelling of the righteous. Toward the scorners he is scornful, but to the humble he gives favor. The wise will inherit honor, but fools get disgrace. Proverbs chapter 3. First relationship is that we're neighbors. Let's look to our neighbors. Every single person in this room has a neighbor. It's a bond of all humanity that we exist in proximity to one another. A neighbor may be a person that has an address that's on the same street as you. A neighbor might be the person who works in the cubicle next to you. It might be the person who answers your question at Home Depot or brings your food when you're sitting at Applebee's. Dare I even say that the neighbor may be the person who you go to church with. And maybe the person you go to church with is, you know, I don't see many people. They don't have many opportunities. But maybe the person you go to church with is your son or your daughter or your mother or your father. They're your closest neighbors in your family. And every person has a neighbor. While we have a higher, you know, perhaps capacity that some people have more than others, but neighbors are not to be neglected and they're not to be ignored. They're not to be mistreated because the goal with these people is trust. Trust. If you live next door to people for years, you mow your lawns and say hi when you're out taking a walk. If you have a coworker, you do your job well in both effort and skill. If someone's serving you at a restaurant or a store, you just treat them respectfully. If you're at church with someone, you communicate well with them and you show care and you develop that relationship because your neighbors will be great opportunities to find wisdom. As you instill trust in them, they also instill trust in you. But neighbors are actually in the minority because the majority of the world's made up of strangers. The relationship moves from strangers to just an unknown man, and from neighbors to an unknown man. And it sounds like a stranger because you have no reason to treat him in a certain way. Seemingly, there's no relationship with this man that you encounter. But for some reason, something's stirring up because we're contending with them. But why? Why are we contending with this person? Why is there strife already? Because it sounds like a stranger. Well, I'm not mean to strangers. I don't contend with them. I don't create strife with them. Well, let me ask you, if you're walking down the streets of Lansing one day and somebody comes up to you that doesn't look the way that you want them to look, what's your immediate reaction to them? Or maybe you're out with your kids at the playground and there's another kid who's near your kid who's obviously a bigger kid and maybe he just looks a little gruff. And your immediate instinct is going to say, you're going to hurt my kid. The lady at the store, like, get out of my way. I need to get to my chips. Whatever you're looking for. Or you're watching the news and, oh, I don't even know who that politician is besides their name, but I promise you they're crooked. And we create contention with strangers all the time. Instead, wisdom says, give them some benefit. And wisdom does play into it at some point, absolutely, but right from the start, you meet a stranger. Immediately, we're drawn to contention by nature. Why do we start with that contention when maybe we should start with benefit? Instead of having contention with strangers, if we do have contention with strangers, our life is going to be dominated by that contention with strangers because our life is dominated by strangers. There's more strangers than there are neighbors. Instead, if we give them benefit, then maybe we could find ourselves having relationships that we've never had before. The last stop on the relationship train is enemies. What wisdom is there in enemies? And you're going to say, oh, Bob, he's going to tell me to just go give him a hug. I just know it. That guy, that hippie. And the final verses of the chapter are devoted to enemies who do violence and are wicked and are scorners and are foolish. And I can't agree, though. You know, even the author doesn't call them enemies, but you can kind of understand that maybe we should consider these people perhaps by the way that Solomon treats them. You might want to reconsider how you classify them if you see wicked and scorners and foolish and violence as people that maybe are not seen as enemies. And we can tell that there's this view of them because they have curse and they have punishment and they have separation and they have bad relationships. The negative is found with those people, while the positive is found in the opposite of people who practice wisdom. And the theme that Solomon is getting across here is safety. Safety from these people who cause damage. These people will be encountered, but we know what comes of them, and we know what will come to those who identify and react rightly to them. So we'll ask for the last time, where is Jesus? Where is Jesus in the midst of all this? And the truth is that Jesus creates a relationship that we don't even see here in these verses. Perhaps we consider ourselves neighbors. We're generally good people. I show up at Graham every Sunday and I serve and I help and I do all of these really good things. I'm a good person. I'm maybe a neighbor. And Jesus says, I have something that I can offer you today, salvation. It's here and it's available now to make us better than a neighbor. Or maybe you're a stranger to Christ. Maybe you're new to Graham and church as a whole is really uncomfortable even, not familiar. Like this whole thing. You're just like, this is weird. Is he going to stop soon? That'd be great. And Jesus doesn't judge us. And Jesus doesn't condemn us. And Jesus may be a stranger to us, but understand his relationship is different because we're not a stranger to him. Because Jesus sees us and he knows us and he understands us and he's ready and he's willing to accept us to not be a stranger anymore. Which brings up the last one, enemies. And every single person is an enemy at the end of the day. Because our sin and our heart and our ways are against the ways of God and we call that sin. The verses point out us deserving judgment and cursing and rejection and distance from God. But Christ created a new outcome for his enemies. A new relationship for his enemies. To receive benefit because he bore what we deserve. Because Jesus offers a relationship unlike any other. We call that salvation. And Jesus offers it to you here, today, and now, better than wisdom. And that's the purest, truest wisdom that we could possibly find in Christ. In conclusion, back to our joke with Timmy. Good old Timmy. Sounds like a duck, but I think the answer is Jesus. And we've spent all morning talking about wisdom. We do want to give you some practical steps of wisdom. They can take home and you can use and you can find wisdom in so many different ways and opportunities in your life. But the danger, though, is that wisdom can be described and recommended and even accomplished. And you can exclude God the entire way. The danger is that character, motivation, experience, and relationships can be accomplished with God, but it's going to fall short and be incomplete every time. Because there are people in this world with extremely good character, but without God. The best gentlemen, the greatest politicians, the people who want to do the best good for the environment, for the world, and for the people around them. They can have great character, absolute gems, but be an atheist, a Buddhist, or a Muslim. Perhaps the most motivated people in the world, athletes that have regimens and training that we can't even touch. Or you see these inspirational videos of people who pursue goals and hopes and dreams that we can't even imagine. And they do it because they want to feel good about themselves because of how great the humanity is, without a mention of God. A personal example for experience. One of the greatest examples in my life of work ethic and finances is my Grandpa Young. My Grandpa Young taught me what it means to work hard, and he worked very hard. There's never a time he sits down. My Grandpa Young taught me a lot about finances, opened up my first bank account, which I then blew in about a week. But he still taught me through that. And my grandpa taught me some great wisdom from his experience, but my Grandpa Young has absolutely no experience with a relationship with God. For relationships, there's some outrageously dynamic people in the world who we can't help but be drawn to, who understand us, who listen to us, who create a relationship in us that maybe we don't even find here in a church on Sunday morning. And even the world, you ask the world, where do you find your relationships? Where are the people you trust the most? Chances are their answer isn't going to be somebody who's in attendance on Sunday morning sitting in a seat in a church like ours or even our own. That's difficult because there is great wisdom in the world and God has allowed people that don't even know him to experience it, to exhibit it, and to have access to it as well. In fact, there will be people that are much more motivational and better communicators who can speak a much better wisdom message than I can even hear this morning. This passage can be taught excluding God and it is almost every single day. And you'll find that it still makes sense. And it still sounds good. And still motivational. It's still full of all this good wisdom. And there's a world of people who hear good advice, but they miss the heart at the end of the day because they reject the God. At the end of the day, Solomon isn't trying to sell you on wisdom. He's trying to sell you on God. At the end of the day, I'm not trying to tell you be wise people. I'm telling you to be redeemed people. at the end of the day, all of this points back to God, because character without God is going to fail. Motivation is going to be found lacking. Experience is always going to be imperfect, and relationships are going to be incredibly unfulfilling if you miss the heart of wisdom. Because wisdom is found in God. And God looks at these words, at our attempt for good character, at our motivation for what's best, at our experiences, at our relationships, and He says, I see your attempt, I see your desire, I see your need, and your need isn't wisdom, your need is salvation. And I will redeem your wisdom, and you will find it in my Son. And when you find Him, and when you know Him, and when you understand Him, when you have a relationship with Him, then you will be able to answer the question that we've been asking all morning long. Where is wisdom? And there's wisdom in these verses that I hope you take home, and I hope you work on, and specifics that are here for us to learn and grow toward. But at the end of the day, if wisdom were found in one single location, it's in the gospel. It's in who Christ is. It's in who He is and what He has done, what He is today, and what He forevermore will be. And we have access to that wisdom. And we hope that you share with that with us this morning. Join me in prayer.